Good morning, everyone, and thank you for the opportunity to address this forum here this morning. This time last year, those of us that were involved in infrastructure delivery were consumed by the threat of increasing inflation. It was driving up the price of steel and fuel by around 10% a month. How quickly things have changed. What I believe, if you look backwards in sort of 2007, 2008, we had a hugely unstable environment, and what we suffered at the end of 2008 was a gigantic earthquake, an economic earthquake, just as those that study geology and plate tectonics realise that you have earthquakes and the plates of the earth move, never to return. What we had at the end of 2008 was a gigantic economic earthquake, and the economic plates of the world have moved, never to return to where they were before. Few anticipated the strength, volatility and speed of the economic earthquake that has shaken the world economy. And my view is that we will experience the aftershocks for some time to come. And in hindsight, there was a number of pre-earthquake tremors, but few of us took sufficient notice. When I attended the World Economic Forum in Davos in 2006 and 2007, where supposedly the best and brightest met to talk about the future, both forums were dominated by discussions about super cycles, commodity booms, peak oil, and skill shortages. This year's forum, which I did not attend, but reports indicate it was all about how long the financial instability will last. Could they be a collapse of the world financial sector, and how far the world economy will fall? It seems many at the forum were bewildered by how quickly this had all happened against their backdrop of predictions 1 year earlier. However, what has really changed, apart from a massive hit to business and consumer confidence? The need for increased spending on first-class infrastructure to support employment and make our economy more efficient is more important than ever. And just as in that earthquake, or the real earthquake that I referred to, you see all sorts of contradictions in our world that we now live. In a real earthquake, you can see on one side of a street a building remaining intact, you see on the other side of the street a great heap of rubble. And that's what we see in this world now we live in. We are seeing at present numerous contradictions in relation to projects. We are winning new mining projects in Indonesia, Mongolia and Australia, but at the same time we're experiencing production slowdowns in other mines. So in the month of February, the Leighton Group won something like $3 billion worth of new mining contracts, but I suppose if you live in Mackay or Rockhampton, where the front page of the daily newspaper says mine closures, world is ending. There's lots of contradictions, and it's really a reflection of the instability of the market that we're in at this point in time. In the Middle East, of course, it's very fashionable to predict the end of the world. We've seen projects cancelled. At the same time, we've been awarded new and larger projects. And one of the contradictions that I talk about there was in the month of December, we were awarded the biggest building ever to be built in the world. You would question why, but it's been awarded 1.6 million square metres of building, and literally 1 kilometre down the road we were building and underway with one of the world's biggest apartment towers, some 90 stories. It was stopped, so in just a few weeks of each other. So there is a big contradiction. In this context, it is encouraging that governments around the world are looking to infrastructure investment to breathe life back into the global economy. A few weeks ago, President Obama addressed the Congress and said, "History reminds us that every moment of our economic upheaval and transformation, this nation has responded with bold action and big ideas. He mentioned the past achievements in the challenging economic times of the establishment of universal public education and efforts to upgrade the nation's infrastructure. He talked about the Highways Act of 1956, which built some 40,000 miles of motorway, and compared his $27 billion Roads and Recovery Act to that an Eisenhower initiative. These are commendable initiatives. In a similar vein, the Australian government is to be commended for its economic stimulus initiatives, including the commitment to upgrade our nation's infrastructure. There is no better time to do this. The challenge for Australia is to bring on the projects more quickly than they have been in the past. We are now in a much, much more complex environment, and it will require political courage and leadership, but it is possible to expedite projects from rhetoric to reality. People talk about the Snowy Mountains and all of those big projects, but everyone needs to be reminded that in those times governments just did the projects. There wasn't the raft of roadblocks, regulatory approvals and whatever else that you now in fact have. On some of our big projects that we've done, say like Lane Cove Tunnel, there was 300 people working full-time on the regulatory approvals during the course of the project. However, the traditional way of project delivery will not allow the government's ambitious timetable to be achieved. We're experiencing extraordinary times at present, and governments need to be prepared to change the rules to meet these challenges. Today I will focus on two key issues to deliver infrastructure during the global financial crisis: implementation and financing. The global economy is facing the most serious downturn in 60 years. The US subprime crisis has moved across virtually all assets, markets and economies, testing the very fundamental pillars of the global financial system, that is capital, liquidity and confidence. Whilst I don't have a crystal ball, I believe we're rumbling somewhere along the bottom of the cycle, although it's impossible to predict when the upswing will start and how long it will be in terms of real growth. Recently I did a TV interview for the ABC, and the interviewer sort of pressed me about, you know, when did I think all this was going to end? And I said, well, it's only with the benefit of hindsight, when you look back, you'll be able to say, you know, the bottom was sort of X date. Anyhow, the interviewer pressed me and said, well, like, I want a prediction, like, when is it going to end? And I said, 10th of August this year. She said, well, that's rather precise. What's so special about that date? I said, well, as good as any other date, it's my birthday. So watch the 10th of August. The International Monetary Fund forecasts that the world economy will begin to recover next year, which is more or less my view. One of my favourite sayings is that you should not be too heavily influenced by recent events, which is all very well to say, but when the immediate past and the future looks bleak, but the fact is that we'll come through this period and the economies will grow again. Australia is better placed than most countries at present to ride out the downturn, thanks to a number of years of strong budget surpluses. We also have more flexibility in monetary policy to stimulate the economy by cutting interest rates. While commodity prices are down by 50% or more, the weaker Australian dollar will offset some of these impacts by improving our export competitive position. The federal government's initiative to quickly announce two stimulus packages should also support our economy in the short term. Construction is an important part of the Australian economy. Over the decade to 2005, 2006, the construction sector was the second largest contributor to GDP. Despite the economic slowdown, the Australian construction market is expected to remain at historically high levels. Total engineering construction is expected to continue to grow this year to around $60 billion. According to IBIS, engineering construction is expected to double to $140 billion by 2018, more or less doubling within a decade. And if you study that graph, if you go back to like 88, you can see it was like 10 billion and it went 10 billion to 60 billion and 60 billion to 140 odd billion. I did say to Phil Rivenhoop, but can you just mind filling in the little gaps in between? So we'll wait to fill that in. From the Leighton Group's perspective, we have a lot of work on and see significant projects in Australia in the future. For example, in Victoria, we are bidding the desalination plant and we expect to see more public investment in roads and rail under the $38 billion Transport Action Plan. We also await Sir Rod Eddington's report to the federal government on priority projects, which is due to be released in the next few weeks. There is no doubt that the federal government's $52 billion in stimulus packages are thoughtful and timely. The clear objective is to save jobs now by stimulating the economy with spending on infrastructure. So this brings me to my first point, implementation. Infrastructure projects are big, complex and expensive. It is not realistic to think that an underground metro rail project or a big undersea tunnel for a desalination plant will be delivered in a matter of months. Under the usual processes, projects like this take years to be delivered. Each phase of the project, from geological surveys, environmental approvals, design and tender, can take a number of years from announcement to construction start. Under traditional delivery methods, it sometimes takes as long to bid the job as it does to build it. The traditional model of procurement is flawed in terms of rapid implementation. Not only does it require long lead times, but often projects are delivered over budget, late, involves disputes about quality, performance, and risk allocation. We need an appropriate model that will work in this current economic environment. If governments want to move from the rhetoric to reality for priority projects, they need to be prepared to do these phases of the project concurrently rather than sequentially. There are a range of alternative models to choose from, such as alliance contracting. Alliance contracting involves bringing the contractor in at early stages of the project, at inception, where the feasibility and qualification studies are being conducted. It means skilled resources are available to public officials when they are scoping the design throughout the project. A strong relationship develops, underpinned by common goals, trust and cooperation. The result is that the client gets the cost-effective design they want, and the contractor has the opportunity to influence the design processes to ensure that the project can be built efficiently. Projects are completed within cost and time, with high safety, environmental and community relations standards. Alliance contracting offers the best and quickest way to get projects started. It is very much an open book process, so the client knows what's being spent and how it's being spent, and the contractor gets to share the risks and rewards with the client. There has been a number of very excellent projects delivered by alliance and contracting in recent years. For example, the Alliance team who worked on the $61 million road separation at Middleborough in Melbourne's eastern suburbs has won awards for its innovative approach to project delivery. By undertaking the major works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the project, which would have normally taken 18 months to complete, was finished in 4 weeks, some remarkable achievement. It requires the courage to pick a winner early on and work together in a real partnership to get the job done. The question is, do we want to create jobs now, or do we want to get bogged down in mindless red tape and 15-digit calculations with a theoretical model to determine whether the taxpayers are getting the absolute best deal? In the end, the taxpayer will benefit because the investment will bear fruit earlier and will assist to stave off jobs and prevent a deeper downturn in this particular cycle. Queensland in particular has done a very successful job. In the current circumstances, speed is of the essence, and public servants need to acknowledge that a trade-off is required if we're to bring projects forward. The second point is how to encourage private financing of infrastructure. I don't believe there is anyone in the audience today, whether from the public or private sector, sees no value in PPPs. Where PPPs have been controversial, or where they have suffered financially, these PPP or completed projects have been very valuable additions to the physical infrastructure of our communities. The negative press about PPPs, where they have not performed as expected, virtually completely and totally relate to the financial failures of these projects. PPP infrastructure projects such as the Alice Springs to Darwin railway line and the Cross City Tunnel in Sydney are great additions to our national infrastructure. The central issue is that they didn't perform from a financial perspective. Australian governments, on the whole, are supportive of using public-private partnerships where appropriate as one of the range of available procurement options. I note that the first PPP at Commonwealth level, the new defence headquarters at Bungendore near Canberra, was a latent contractor's ABN AMRO project, won the Infrastructure Partnership Project of the Year award this year. I mean, this project I know very well was an exceptionally successful project from all parties. There's many pipeline PPPs in the pipeline over the decade, as it shows on this particular graph, various markets and the like. So it's going to be a big market over the future. But as I said earlier, the world has changed dramatically, and we're not returning to former times. Not soon, and maybe not ever. While the private sector is still keen to invest, the reality is funding is not available. Without an evolution of the model and government assistance in adding liquidity to the market, PPPs will struggle to be delivered. The global financial crisis has removed many major players from the infrastructure financing market, including monoline insurers, major bond providers, major guarantee suppliers such as AIG, and has put pressure on the balance sheets of traditional banks. Debt syndication markets are thin and in some areas does not exist. Those banks that are prepared to participate are looking at a smaller stake and requiring a higher return. Greenfield projects are competing for capital against brownfield projects as existing projects try to refinance from a smaller capital pool. Capital markets for these projects are still effectively closed. The Reserve Bank pointed out in February's statement on monetary policy that the availability of credit for new project developments may slow the economic recovery. From the banks that Leighton talked to, and we talked to a substantial number of banks, the consensus appears that it is exceptionally difficult to fund a PPP project larger than $500 or $600 million at this point in time. If the government wants these projects to proceed in the short to medium term, they will need to assist with project liquidity or provide greater flexibility to sponsors to manage revenue risk or both. It must be remembered that these are long-term assets with concessions generally 30 years or more. Eventually, liquidity will return to these markets, but we need action and assistance from governments to overcome short-term lack of liquidity. There are a range of options to reduce exposure to financiers and investors and potentially increase willingness to participate in these projects. Some of these options include larger upfront contributions from government, supported debt models, wrapped government funding where the government underwrites liquidity, allowing partial underwriting at bid close. Another alternative is for the government to procure the project itself via a design and construct or alliance model and possibly sell the mature assets after ramp up. All new infrastructure projects have an economic worth and make our economy more efficient and Australia more competitive, and most projects eventually return to their true economic worth. All of these options should be considered, and whatever model meets the market risk appetite should be chosen. In the current market, the more support the government can provide, the more likely it is for the project to proceed. I believe the federal government should consider the reintroduction of infrastructure bonds, which were effective in getting projects such as the Eastern Distributor in Sydney and Melbourne CityLink off the ground in the 1990s. The bonds carried a tax advantage and were terminated in the mid-90s because the ATO were concerned about alleged rorting of the scheme. Perhaps the federal government should have another look at these infrastructure bonds in the context of the current environment. We recognise and support the move by Infrastructure Australia to standardise procurement guidelines for PPPs. This could help reduce the costs if states and their advisers stick to proven models and don't try to reinvent the wheel and push the risk boundaries, with every new project having some variation to the theme. As the guidelines identify, better interaction with bidders during the tender process can also reduce project risks and costs by providing greater certainty and flexibility around key issues. These include design outcomes, capacity requirements, service delivery, project phasing, and the ranking of project outputs. National PP guidelines need updating to take into account the new market realities, and I support a national approach to this situation. There also may be a role for the federal government to assist the states in providing liquidity into PPP markets in the short term. We really need to focus on the partnership feature of the model if we're to get infrastructure projects that everyone agrees needed to get these projects moving. One of the results of the current circumstances should be to reduce bid costs and streamline contract conditions. A lot is made about risk transfer and written about in the newspapers, but very little is focused on actually the inherent risks in building a number of these jobs. Bid costs remain too high and limit the range of participants, from a financier's and constructor's viewpoint. This is partly because governments continue to shortlist teams to best and final offers rather than selecting a preferred bidder. Only large companies or joint ventures have the financial and staffing capacity to tender for mega projects and to bear the risks of losing up to $40 million or more in tender costs. On both the government and private sectors, these large tenders can tie up considerable resources, such as people, for a very long time, and it's not unusual on a big project to have maybe 300 staff working for 18 months. It's a huge commitment. Governments need to recognise the current capacity limitations of our markets, and for the larger projects they should move more quickly to shortlisting no more than two bidders and move to a preferred bidder earlier. I was recently in Japan with Sir Rod Eddington with an Australian mission, and that mission was informed that the number of bidders per project in Japan has been falling year by year, to the extent of PPPs or similar projects in Japan receive only four bids. We're also told that the percentage of tendered projects where no valid bids was received has climbed year by year. In this particular slide here on the screen, in 2007, 40% of projects received no valid bids. I believe in 2008 it was even higher, that 40 to 50% of projects that were put to the market received no valid bids, and I think that probably shocked a number of people in the audience. That their reasons in Japan are similar to Australia, why no valid bids are put forward. It's associated with such things as financing costs, tender costs, onerous contract conditions, lack of certainty, and. The costs and bonds and guarantees have also been rising very substantially as a result of the contraction in the market, where people like AIG, have dropped completely out of the market. The cost of bonds and guarantees, in fact, has probably doubled over the last several months. We see this at a time where some clients are trying to increase bonding requirements of up to 20%, which is $200 million on a billion-dollar project. This is at the same time that the international market for bonds and guarantees is dramatically reduced. There are very few participants that can carry these bonding requirements on their own balance sheet. And it's just a fact of reality that the bonds are not available. They are just not available. Unreasonable contract conditions add to project costs and take additional time as the preferred bidder negotiates commercial contract conditions with the client. There are some extreme examples emerging from state government departments and agencies, and this seems completely contradictory to me from the rhetoric of politicians who want to get these projects moving. In a recent project, I must add, not in Victoria, the client wanted indemnification for any and all of the information supplied by them. I mean, how outrageous is that? I mean, the government wanting to be indemnified by the contractor. In some of these cases, I've seen examples where the government can spend 2 years doing survey work in a particular job, 2 years, and you have to indemnify the government for the survey work. And in a particular case, in one section of the survey work was wrong by 2 metres. And they said, you signed the indemnity. They might say, once bitten, twice shy. You see things of 15% bonding, where 5% is normal, 1% cash retention for 2 years after the project completed. Demands by the clients that all risks such as geological risk, contamination risk are accepted. These sorts of conditions are unacceptable to contractors. In any event, it's impossible for the contractors in many ways to validate the information. If you have a long undersea tunnel, it maybe takes the government agency 1 or 2 years to take rigs out to sea, drill for the geological information, dish it up to you and say you have to accept all of the risks associated with that. There is no way the contractor could A, validate it, or even B, be in a position to undertake the necessary work in the time frame, and C, probably spend the money, which is a huge amount of money. So we see in the current environment lots of contradictions happening where governments are saying they want to accelerate projects, but the other time you see various government agencies, you know, going the complete reverse direction. So in conclusion, the current markets require a changed approach to procurement and financing of infrastructure projects. Governments will need to take decisive action early in project development to cut through the red tape that usually slows delivery. They should pick a winner early, not focus on and not force businesses into long and expensive contests. Alliances have consistently proven to be cheaper and faster way of completing infrastructure projects rather than the traditional procurement models. So it will require a fundamental rethink of PPPs. Whilst the model is not dead, it's grasping for breath. There is a large potential market for PPPs in Australia in the next decade. The reality is that the government can't fund everything. And my answer is, if the government can fund everything, they just should get on and do it. Now more than ever, there is a need to focus on true partnerships with the private sector to get infrastructure happening to stimulate our economies and more particularly provide jobs in these rather uncertain times. I guess my final comment is that it goes along the lines that we should focus on what we have and not what we don't have. And what I mean by that is that we need to recognise the reality of where we are in the world and be able to move forward and not dream of things that we don't have. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Wal. We've got a couple of minutes left over, so if you'd like to take any questions.
Hi, Wal. My name's Paul O'Connor. I'm from the Victorian Auditor General's Office. And one of the things we've been looking at is the effectiveness of PPPs, particularly social infrastructure delivery. I just wanted to get your view on whether you think, when you look at the PPP model of DBFM, whether we can still achieve the same outcomes without necessarily getting too caught up in the financing side. Well, the question is, do you think that, as you said on the alliances issue, do you think there's a chance to take that model forward without getting too caught up in the current financing problems in terms of achieving the same outcomes for public infrastructure?
Well, I'll try and... I think you're asking me that in an alliance model, are you still going to have, you know, funding issues? Well, I mean, actually, none of this is rocket science. In terms of getting all of this done, it's a question of who bears the risk at the end of the day, both the financial risks and, you know, the technical risks and the cost risks. So in a licensing model, if the government were to, with the contractors, underwrite, you know, the structure, and there's many, many models that you can use for, you know, fixing the certainty of the project in terms of costing, and then so it's unbundled from the financing, then the financing becomes a separate issue. The traditional, you know, PPP, where, you know, the financiers and the governments require absolute certainty to 20 decimal places to underwrite a firm construction contract, and then allow, you know, various other components to go in to do the financial modelling, I just don't think that people are going to participate in that market anymore. And one of the problems, for example, in the previous model has been that the lack of ability to have scope changes, that there's a construction price defined, and on that's a lump sum price. On the top of that construction price, you get then equity and debt players. They all go into place and it all happens. Then the client comes along and wants changes, but there's no money to pay for those particular changes. So none of it's actually rocket science. I mean, any of these models can participate, but it really requires a greater sharing around of the risk.
I guess I'm just more interested in the 30-year life of the asset that a PPP, what we're seeing is that seems to be where a PPP brings the best value, and the fact it's going to be maintained for 25, 30 years, and that's built into the contract. I mean, you're mainly, I think, talking about the construct component. I'm just wondering, do you think constructors need to move into the 30-year whole life asset space through long-term maintenance agreements that are bolted on perhaps to an alliance agreement to get the same or similar outcomes without getting too caught up on the financing side?
Well, if you move to the long-term, you know, maintenance side, they have a thing called a private sector comparator. I mean, in the private sector comparator is in essence a model to demonstrate that, you know, how does the cost compare with doing it themselves. You'd need a Hewlett-Packard calculator, 15 decimal places sometime, to understand the private sector comparator. But as we well know, things change. So how can you, in reality, possibly run a model for 25 years on the cost of maintaining an asset, let's say a hospital, with any degree of certainty? And if only I were to rest my case on what the economic gurus said 2 years ago about the economy going forward. So long, complicated calculations are done to say either the government agency can maintain this more efficiently than private sector. But I can tell you, if we get a big burst of inflation in, say, 10 years' time, inflation runs through to 15, like, none of that means anything. So long-term models require some sort of appropriate reset in resetting, because how can anyone predict what's going to happen in 25 years? And so I rest my case, just go back 3 years and see what all the economic models. There is a place for private sectors, and I suppose I classify the models into two components, which is like, the PPPs, the build, own, operate transfers, like tollways, which are built and operated and eventually make their way to the government, where there's a big patronage risk. Then there's the social PPPs, like hospitals, where the physical assets, like a hospital, is constructed and maintained by private sector, but the actual people that operate it, you know, from a day-to-day sense, like the nurses and doctors are government employees. So there's many distinctions. So the social infrastructure can either be education facilities, hospitals, you know, correctional facilities or whatever. But in the long-term maintenance, the evaluation of what the government can do to maintain that asset versus what private enterprise can do. And in reality, no one knows what's going to happen in 20 years.
Thank you.